This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick on Twitter at OldFLA and visit his website, rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Welcome back to Florida Spectacular. Hey, Rick, how are you doing over there in the middle of this glorious, sunshiny state?
It actually got a heavy rain yesterday, which was a big surprise. First big rain we've had in a long time, and it does not feel like November.
No, it's warmer in November than it was for most of October, which is very odd for us.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a lightweight when it comes to a house with no air conditioning. And after we had lost power for Milton and we opened the windows, obviously, and it was beautiful. And for most of October, we left the windows open with very few exceptions, but I've been creeping back into reliance on air conditioning, which I know my beleaguered husband probably hates because he loves the fresh air. I mean, I do too, but I have a lower tolerance for feeling sweaty and yucky.
Yeah, my walks this week have felt more like August than November, and it's kind of depressing.
I mean, it's still better than a blizzard.
Yeah, I suppose so. We actually had a fire by our chimney last month, and I collected all this firewood, and I kept thinking, okay, we're going to have fire and drink wine by the fire, in the fall, and just it'll be charming, and it has not happened because it's just been too warm.
Yeah, we're in this place where it's really just a little too chilly for us to go in the pool without turning the heat on, but not chilly enough to fire up the fire pit.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping. Okay. We'll get there.
Yeah, my mom said, yeah, maybe there'll be a cold snap before Thanksgiving, and it's like, I sure hope so, because there's a lot of mosquitoes around my backyard, and we usually have Thanksgiving outdoors.
Well, maybe they just want to join the party, Rick.
Yes.
They have a lot to be thankful for, too. Don't forget, mosquitoes are pollinators. So we're planting all these wonderful plants to attract pollinators, and that's going to include mosquitoes. And they're thankful for all your milkweed.
No milkweed. Remember, I got rid of my milkweed.
I know, the whole milkweed thing.
Yeah.
One of the guys who works with me, his partner decided this year, instead of getting candy, she was going to hand out milkweed packets to kids. And he came home and saw that, and he's like, nope, grabbed a packet of milkweed seeds, and he went out and bought candy. He's like, our house will get egg. We cannot do this. So he brought him into the office, and I was tempted. He's like, everybody take some milkweed seeds. And I'm like, oh, you know what I should do? I should send some of those packages to Rick. He'd love it.
Actually, I must admit, there's a volunteer that came up, and I haven't pulled it yet, but I will. It's definitely the non-native kind. I haven't had much luck with the native kind. It'll last, it might last a year or so, and then it goes away. And it doesn't seem to reseed itself and come back. So I really would, and I haven't been getting tons of flower. Whereas the non-native kind, as long as it doesn't get chewed up by monarchs, it seems to come back again and again and again.
I've got to tell you, monarchs or no, though, we've had some beautiful butterflies in our yard. It's really just been lovely. So I'm not one who can identify butterflies easily. I mean, I have friends who can go, oh, that's a Gulf Fritillary, or that's a White Southern Baptist, or whatever they call them. And
the White Southern Baptist.
I don't think that's actually an actual taxonomy. I might have been conflating some things, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I'm not that person. We should actually have a lepidopterist on the podcast to talk about Florida butterflies, not just monarchs. Monarchs really do get the lion's share of attention. But we have some truly beautiful butterflies in Florida. So,
there's that one kind that the Kunti plant is its larval host. And it's that like Atalaya or something.
I can't pronounce any of it.
Yeah. But, it's a great comeback story because so many people were planting Kunis in their yards and they were almost gone. And I stumbled across some in Melbourne. They were, there was some kind of palm that was blooming, and they were just going nuts. And their wings are slightly iridescent. It was one of the most magical butterfly experiences I've ever had in the wild.
So my My favorite butterfly experience, and we promise this is not a podcast about butterflies today, although it's sounding like one. Brad Bertelli, who co-hosts the Florida Keys Spectacular with me, he is the expert on all things Indian Key down in the Florida Keys. And it was the first time we were there. Barry and I met him at Robbie's, and he put in at Robbie's, and we paddled from Isla Mirada to Indian Key. You know, Indian Key was initially selected as a settlement in the 19th century because it had no mosquitoes. But we get there and there are so many white butterflies. It was like someone, and this was daytime, it was like someone had strung fairy lights between all the trees. And it was just, you were completely immersed in them. And it's my singular, most spiritual moment with butterflies.
I wonder if those were the Southern Baptist variety.
They were Southern something, and I can never remember because we do have two different Southern butterflies, Southern white something, and I always get them mixed up. But I'm pretty sure it wasn't the Southern white Baptist.
Maybe it was the Southern Baptist. Is one of them the white sulfur, perhaps?
You know, we're going to have to wait until
we'll get a butterfly person.
We're going to have to get a lepidopterist in here and on here and discuss those things. But anyway. Speaking of the weather, which is where this started for some reason, it's getting to be just chilly enough, or hopefully soon, that instead of going to the beaches, people are going to feel really good about going to the springs, because the springs are constant temperature and they're not all the same temperature, but they are, whatever temperature they are, is relatively constant. And when it's 60 degrees outside, a 72 or a 68 degree spring feels pretty damn good. Honestly. So, you know, my mind turns to spring right around November, December. And I think there's one you wanted to talk about today, right?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about one of my favorite. There's actually two Ponce de Leon spring state parks in this state. One is in Holmes County, I believe, in the Panhandle. But there's one about less than an hour from Orlando called in Volusia County, which is our Ponce de Leon Springs, or I just call it De Leon Springs.
Well, that's actually what it's called, is De Leon Springs.
Oh, there's no Ponce. Okay, thank you.
Not officially in the name. It's De Leon Springs State Park.
Well, they've gone back and forth. I have some of the marketing from when they first rebranded it as Ponce de Leon Springs back before it was a state park, where they used the Ponce name. And so they've used the image of Ponce quite frequently in their marketing. You know, there's at one point, as you drove in, they had this statue of Ponce de Leon in this bathing beauty in this kind of 1950s one-piece bathing suit. But they disappeared and nobody knows where they are. And you can still see there's kind of a map. It's kind of a, not a mosaic, but like a terracotta bas relief maybe of where they used to stand right by the visitor's booth as you drive in the state park. And I think maybe the bathing beauty disappeared first and then Ponce disappeared separately. And nobody knows what happened to them. They were life size. They were really cool.
Life size. So somewhere in somebody's private collection is a life size bathing beauty and a life size Ponce de Leon, who wasn't he quite short though?
I don't know. There's all these stories about how short the Spaniards were compared to the Timucuans and all that kind of stuff. You know, we do know that the diets were probably better for the indigenous people living here. So, you know, maybe they were healthier.
Well, they didn't have gluten, so that probably had that going for them.
I think that's a myth, though, that there's, you know, these 5-foot Spaniards running around with these 8-foot Timucuans. And I think people love that story, and it's been repeated. We should do a whole podcast
on
the myth.
Wait, are you telling me that the narratives about the American Indians are not necessarily true?
And it's so funny because in some of these brochures I've seen, like for Ponce de Leon Springs and the Fountain of Youth, they'll often depict the, you know, indigenous people with the full Plains Indian headdress behind them, you know, with all the feathers, like they were
right.
You know, from,
yeah, I love that.
Tribe
they're
out
not.
West.
You know, they probably more realistically fish scales. You know, why would you, my thing is, why would you settle for bison if you could have stone crab? But you know, anyway, De Leon Springs is named not for the people who lived there for so many years, but one of the people single-handedly responsible for a lot of their deaths. So that's really great.
It's marketing. It's all marketing. A guy named Fred Burt, they say he was the one responsible for the name. At one point, he had his own little attraction off to the side, and he actually had water. My cat is bugging me right now, and he drilled a well and got to the aquifer and created a swimming pool, and there was a whole swimming area called Burt's Park. Actually, was just to the southwest, perhaps, of the main spring, and he's the one who renamed it. It was originally called Spring Garden for many years, and it wasn't until they started going after the tourists that they rebranded it. But it has some wonderful history.
So I guess this is not the actual Fountain of Youth, right? I mean, do we want to talk? Have we talked before about what a complete bunch of cockamamie that is, or just do we call it Annette? I mean, how have we talked about that? I feel like we must have, but it might just be something I talk about all the time.
I don't know. It's the topic of my first book. You know, the actual Fountain of Youth. What? Like an actual Fountain of Youth exists. There have been a number of Fountain of Youth attractions across the state. My favorite one, of course, is the one in St. Augustine, but of course you had one in St. Pete, and all over the state, every spring in the world says it was the Fountain of Youth. The whole idea of Ponce de Leon, you know, going across the state looking for a Fountain of Youth is complete BS.
It started as satire, right?
Right. So, well, you know, everybody's satire, and they were also really trying to put down Ponce. You know, Diego Columbus was trying to demean his manhood more than anything.
Right. So Diego Columbus, being Christopher Columbus's son, wanted to be what, the governor of Puerto Rico, and so did Ponce de Leon. So they were trying to, you know, kind of make fun of him, and it's like The Onion or Andy Borowitz. And so a court chronicler wrote this lovely, humorous column about Ponce de Leon is so stupid and so gullible. These we're going to call them Indians. These Indians led him around searching for the Fountain of Youth, you know, kind of like, what an idiot. And the thing is, when he wrote it, I think everybody kind of knew he was being made fun of. Like, nobody actually thought, oh, wow, Ponce de Leon has a line on the Fountain of Youth. But like so many things, if you repeat something enough, people will accept it as fact. Is it, you know, I thank God there was no internet around during this time. Can you imagine what they would have said about Ponce?
The sad thing is, I see it repeated today as if it's the gospel truth. There was an article I read by Henry Louis Gates, who I love, who repeated it like it was fact that Ponce de Leon was in Florida searching for the Fountain of Youth. And it is not. It just got repeated enough that people believed it. It is, you know, it's a fun myth. You know, it's, you know,
Claus.
Yeah. What's his name over there says it's our creation myth for Florida. And, you know,
I think that's a little heavy handed and discounting a whole lot of people who've been here.
Look at it. These people come here to reboot their lives. You know, they want a fresh start. So where do they go to start their lives over, in retirement or to, you know, just to get a new beginning? They come to Florida. It's in our DNA.
Welcome to Untethered and Wanderwise, where adventure has no age limit. We're your co-host, Heidi Brandest and Nikki Amahundro, and we're here to inspire and celebrate women over 45 who are embracing their independence and want to explore the world on their own terms.
Well, I mean, and that you know, that's true. It is some of us, not me, but some of us were born here. Weren't you born here, Rick?
No, I moved here when I was a baby.
Okay, so no one here then. Never mind. Forget that. But apparently people are born here. They have birthing, you know, wings in hospitals.
Maternity wards, yeah. They
whatever, yeah. Yeah.
But you know, that's
the
kind
spring
of
is named for the sky.
Yeah. Well, if we want to talk about the indigenous people there, they have pulled out a couple of canoes from the spring itself to date back to, you know, 6,000 years. So we know there was an indigenous presence going back to the Middle Archaic period. And they found ceremonial burial areas in nearby Tick Island. And there's a big shell midden that's still somewhat intact nearby the spring, and they found human remains there too. So it's likely that you know, the earliest inhabitants of Florida lived around the spring. And then eventually, at the time when the Europeans came, the people living there were the Mayaca people, who were a little bit different from the Tumuqua, who were further north. I think their language was closer to the ice people of the coast. And they were, you know, again, no immunity to disease, so they eventually died off. And then that void was kind of filled in by other Native people who moved in from further north. And those were the people that were here when other Europeans arrived during, or people of European descent arrived during the second Spanish period. But the first person probably in the area was Menendez, who sailed up the St. John's River from St. Augustine.
That was 1565, right?
When he arrived. Yeah, that was a bit ago. And so then the first person of European descent to kind of claim the land was a guy named William Williams, who got
William
a Spanish.
Williams, really?
Yes. He got a Spanish land grant. He originally had land over near Daytona on the Halifax River, and he needed more land because he had a lot of enslaved people, and he started a plantation there and named it Spring Garden.
Enslaved people.
Yeah. So there is a long history of plantations around the spring that utilized enslaved people as labor. There were at least three or four different plantations where they grew everything from indigo to sugar. And, you know, a lot of, Native American stuff. So the plantation was burned during the Second Seminole War, what we call the Second Seminole War, and then troops came in and ran them out. But yeah, there's a lot of history that happened there around that spring.
I do have a question about something, and I don't know if you know the answer, but if you go to the state park website, and they all have their history tabs, right? So you can go to any state park website, and I think all of them now have a tab where you can click a link, you can click history, and it'll tell you about the history of the park, why it's significant. And there's a sentence here that it just doesn't make sense. Let me read you the paragraph. Maybe you can explain it to me. Two sentences. England took possession of Florida from 1763 to 1783, but did not occupy this area. Spain regained control in 1783, and land grants were given to U.S. citizens, starting with William Williams, he was the one Spring Garden. So did Spain give those land grants, or was this part of this clever little thing the new United States did where they would just give land grants on Spanish soil to people who wanted to take it for the United States? Do you know?
Florida became a U.S. territory in 1821. So during that second Spanish period, the Spaniards really couldn't control Florida, Florida at all. And you remember, Florida is huge at this point. It's not just the part that we have now. And a lot of people were moving in, and so they did their best to populate it. And as a means, this is my understanding, to try and control their territory. So they gave people land grant. You know, this guy, William Williams, was born in North Carolina, and he had originally had a plantation, I think, in the Bahamas. And he probably, I don't know whether he was given the land grant or had to buy it. The other thing was there was that Panton and Leslie outfit who were traders with the Native Americans. They seemed to set up operations there at some point, and I believe that was during the English period. But they didn't have a permanent inhabitant there. But if you read a longer history, they talk about their part of it. It eventually became owned by a guy named Orlando Rees, who was a planter, which means, when they say a planter, it means a guy with enslaved people who...
He probably wasn't doing a lot of his own planting, is
no,
what you're saying.
No, exactly, yeah. Yes. And he hired this Scottish engineer to corral the spring pool and build a mill there. And it's one of the... I think there were a number of springs that had mills on site because there was so much flow, you could turn a mill wheel. And he was the first one to build a mill there. And John James Audubon was intrigued by it. And he stopped there in, I believe, the 1830s, perhaps. Yeah, 1832. So Audubon writes about visiting Spring Garden. He talked about the smell. He talked about the thrill of seeing, you know, the dwellings of the enslaved people, and reminded him of Africa. And, you know, John James Audubon is a complicated dude with a very complicated legacy.
We have an exhibit at the MFA in St. Pete right now for of Audubon's work. And the Gabber, we had a critic go and write about it. And she talked about very clearly, and the MFA is not shying away from the fact that, look, this guy enslaved other people. He enslaved Black people. He killed birds to paint and pose them. And he also made up birds. And people were upset. We got a letter to the editor upset that we actually dared to write about this exhibit. He's still a very controversial guy. If you go to the Audubon Society's website, they have a page about what a not nice guy he was.
It's so interesting. Yeah. And it seems like I think there's a new book that UPF just put out about Audubon in Florida by Clay Henderson, if I'm not mistaken. And he is a complicated. I mean, he killed hundreds, if not thousands, of birds in order to make his paintings. And yet, we have the Audubon Society, which is an organization of bird lovers. It's such an interesting, it's a very Florida kind of thing.
I think the society probably didn't really think about the minutiae of what kind of person Audubon was. And then as they became a little more aware, they're like, oh, gosh, we got to probably say something about this. This is not good.
Yeah.
But apparently one of the birds he painted in this area was the limpkin. So
right.
We know that means he probably killed quite a few limpkin in this area.
They used to eat limpkins, which makes me so sad because they're so tame. You know, there's one of the few birds, you know, I can go on my dock and there'll be a limpkin there and it won't fly away because it just sits there and kind of clacks at me. And it seems tame.
Well, because it could peck your eyes out if it wanted to.
But they used to call them swamp chickens, and they would eat them, and it breaks my heart.
Well, you know, we used to do a lot of things that we don't do anymore. Apparently, right here at DeLeon Springs, because there was, cotton and sugar cane, and they supplied the Confederacy?
Yeah, and then the mill was burned down. It was burned down twice, once during the Seminole War and once during the Civil War. One of the more interesting things that has happened recently is there was a professor at Stetson University, which is in DeLand, which is pretty close to DeLeon Springs, who worked with incarcerated researchers in the nearby prison, and they were able to unearth the names of a lot of the enslaved people. So they did this wonderful ceremony at the spring where they spoke the names of the enslaved people out loud.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Getting goosebumps just thinking about it. And there's this great program that, you know, they work with enslaved people and teach them how to be researchers. And some of them, after they are paroled and leave incarceration, actually become historians because of the skills they learn in jail or prison. And they found these names and spoke, you know, and gave them, you know, their power back. That's kind of a hokey way to say it, but you know what I'm trying to get at is they're not invisible anymore when she's
right.
She
I mean,
name.
if you go back through the census records that we have, and they're all publicly available, when we had the practice of enslaving people and the census takers would come through, they were not counted as people. Their names were not written down. It was just a number. And, you know, there were a lot of things. If you look at the old census, it's really chilling to think about. This is how we counted Black people. It's very easy to be okay with something if you can't put a name or a face to it. Right.
It's so hard to research. I've been trying to find nearby on the St. John's River. There was a steamboat captain named Jacob Brock who kind of gave or let one of his enslaved person, he emancipated her and let her be in charge of one of his steamboats. And her name was Commodore Rose. And I've been trying to find out, you know, find her on a record someplace. And I've yet to find it. She's written about in two books. Harriet Beecher Stowe's book about Florida, and another one that I can't remember right now. But I've been trying to find her in the Record of Enslaved People, and it's so hard. I've never found anything. You see, you know, like a record of a female and their age at a certain time, but so you have to guess if that could be her, that could be her, that could be her. It's not. But one of the more interesting things about the enslaved people there is that at the time of emancipation, a lot of them settled further south on Lake Monroe in a little community near Enterprise, and they started their own black community called Garfield, and they did very well. They actually had a train stop there because they grew a lot of citrus, and it was a way to get the citrus to market. And it lasted for a number of years until there was a big freeze, and it just kind of wiped the place off the map. But there's a wonderful rails to trails trail there. It's called the Spring to Spring Trail, and you can find a historical marker about the community of Garfield. That really, the only thing that's left are a couple graves now, and a lot of those were originally enslaved people from one of those plantations at De Leon Springs. I love the place because of the layers of history there. You know, then after all that 19th century history, there's this whole very kitschy roadside his stuff that I love. And it's striking to think they would have things like water skiing elephants and power boats that went through flaming hoops.
Excuse me, did you say water skiing elephants?
Yes.
That could not have been any fun for the elephant.
So, you ready? This is my favorite story because I actually interviewed the girl who grew up with the elephant. It was the elephant's name was Queenie. And so her name was Liz Dane. She grew up, her dad had this animal attraction somewhere in New England. And they did this thing where it was kind of a PR thing where they went to a pet shop in New York City and they let Liz as a little girl pick out any pet she wanted, and they paraded in a baby elephant. So of course she picked the baby elephant for her pet. They took the back seat out of their car, drove it back to, I think they lived in Vermont, and she grew up with Queenie. And every summer they would come down to De Leon Springs, and it really wasn't water ski. It was like a big pontoon boat. And they would put on shows while she was when Liz was in high school, of this water skiing elephant. You can find Mercury boat advertisements with Queenie, the water skiing elephant, on it. And she, you know, she kind of got famous. There were circus people who would winter there as well. So there were circus shows. There were all sorts of stuff. It was a full-on roadside attraction. They had a monkey island, all that kind of stuff. So Liz goes to college. So her dad sells Queenie, the water skiing elephant, and 40 years pass, and Liz is middle age, but she wants to see if Queenie is still alive, and she's able to track Queenie down at this elephant retirement home in Valdosta, Florida. So Liz, who's in her 60s now, goes to look for Queenie, and the people running the place say, "Be careful, because that's a very mean elephant." Well, Queenie the elephant, who hasn't seen Liz for 40 years, remembers her, and they established a relationship. And so when Liz comes to Florida every year, she would visit Queenie until Queenie died about 5 or 6 years ago. I love that.
Elephant
story.
Never forgets.
I know.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, so there's that whole roadside of De Leon Springs.
Well, most of the roadside stuff is gone. The only thing that's really there, and I don't know that I would describe it as kitschy, is the Pancake House.
Yeah, I think
people
it's kitschy.
Love
kind
that
of.
Pancake House.
They do.
Like, so if you're listening and you don't know what we're referring to, the old sugar mill has a Pancake House inside of it, and you can make your own pancakes. There's a griddle at the table. And this is so beloved that a couple of years ago, they announced the company who had been running it, an outside vendor, announced that they were not going to be able to do it anymore. And I mean, this was state park drama. You would have thought that the governor had said, "Let's put a golf course at Jonathan Dickinson State Park." That's the level of drama this was. And you know, no worries. They have a new vendor in there now. You can still go make your pancakes. I mean, to me, that's like the lowest reason to go see an incredible spring and, you know, the history and learn about, you know, what Florida's really like. But if pancakes is what does it for you, go get your pancakes on.
Well, I think I haven't been there since the new vendor took over. The old place was wonderful. There was no air conditioning. And it was, you know, it had, well, on the wall was a framed newspaper from the 19th century talking about the healing powers of the water. So, I love that kind of stuff. It had this kind of grit and grime there that, to me, is akin to taxidermy. It's this kind of funkiness. It's the old Florida vibe. So the new vendor supposedly got rid of all that stuff, and it's kind of like a Cracker Barrel now. So I don't know if it's nearly as charming, but I loved, you go in there, usually there's a wait, so you put your name on the list, you jump in the spring, you get freezing cold, then by the time you get into the restaurant, you've warmed up a little bit, and the fact that there's no air conditioning doesn't bother you because you've been in 72 degrees water, your body temperature is lower.
It's like some weird kind of Florida Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
I love the place. It's one of my favorite places. It is a very complicated history. I will give you a link to an article that is written by a Stetson professor named Robert Sittler, I believe is his name, who talks about, this campy, kitschy history on a place that was obviously sacred to Native Americans because they are interred there and, was worked by all these enslaved Black people for years and years and years. And, we're going there and having fun in the springs. And it's just this, it's kind of like the complexity of Florida all in one place.
Nice way to think about it. You should go there and report back on the Pancake House.
Yeah, I'll be there in February. They have kind of a thing where they bring in reenactors and sell native plants and vendors and all that stuff. And they asked me if I'd go there and sell books. So I told them I would. It's been far too long. I used to go more often than I do. There's wonderful hiking trails around. There's a boat cruise you can take. On the hiking trails, there's this ancient cypress called Methuselah that you can hike to. So there's a lot to do. And I love DeLand. So we normally stop at DeLand on the way up or the way back because I love to go to all the little shops in the downtown area. So it's a great day trip from Central Florida.
It's fantastic. I'm in Vero Beach tonight.
Yay!
And I actually looked to see if it was close enough that we could make a side trip over, and it's really just a little too far. So, but we'll be back. We're waiting on the new truck for our new travel trailer because our existing car will not pull it. So, I'm looking forward to doing the Grand Circle Tour of Florida in that. So
I sent you something via Facebook for Vero Beach. There is a place called Waldo's Garden, which is a wedding venue over there. And it's connected to the Sexton family, of Waldo Sexton. And they're having a yard sale tomorrow. And some of the stuff go back to the Waldo Sexton days.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I will have to go check that out tomorrow. Barry will be thrilled for us to put more stuff in the car to take home.
Some of it looks pretty big. Like they had these big the stuff that really interests me was this big wrought iron stuff you put on your yard. Because, Waldo Sexton, he was known for collecting just this, he's collected weird things like coffins and bells. And supposedly when they were knocking down some of the great Spanish Mediterranean revival architecture of Palm Beach, he'd go and grab handfuls of tile and come back and incorporate it in the architecture. If you get a chance to go out to eat, Ocean Grill is one of my favorite places to eat in Vero.
Ocean Grill?
Yes.
We will check it out. I will report back and we will do a whole podcast episode on Vero Beach after we do the butterflies, after we have a few guests on. We've got a wonderful holiday season planned between Chris Mindel and another author and now
Kim
butterflies,
Love.
Kim Love, Vero Beach. It's a lot of fun. So I think we're good for this episode. We have wet people's metaphorical whistles for De Leon Springs. And maybe some pancakes. So
yay. We need this today.
Yes, it was a good day. It's always a good day when we can talk about Florida.
Yes.
All right, folks, thanks for listening. Don't forget, you can always support this podcast by subscribing to the Florida Keys Spectacular podcast that gets you two extra episodes a month where Brad Bertelli and I talk about all things Florida Keys related, plus a little premium swag here and there. We have stickers we send, magnets. Few people have even gotten t-shirts. So check us out. You can do that. link in the show notes to do all those things. And we will see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.